Strong Enough merch is now available. Please stop by our store and check out the items that you can grab so that you'll always remember that you are strong enough and you are worth it.
Welcome to the Strong Enough Podcast, where we talk about the challenges and celebrate the triumphs of people just like you. I'm your host, Claudia. Today's guest is going to talk about why we often find ourselves in the same situation over and over again, even though we think we've already healed. She's also going to talk about how we sometimes gaslight ourselves in bad situations and what we can do about it. Please help me welcome Stacy Bukauskas. Stacy, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you this morning?
I am well, and I know that we talked about some weird weather happening all across the country, actually, because we're in very different parts. So
we are, but don't panic. It's all good.
Everything's fine.
Everything's fine.
Just like the little GIF with the dog and the fire all around him.
Yes,
everything is fine. Mm-hmm. Stacy, I am super stoked to have you here today. I know that we're going to talk about some really difficult but interesting things. I would love it if first, though, you would tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, I call myself a super smart, highly sensitive creative with a touch of trauma. I think that pretty much sums it up. It only took me like 20 some years after leaving my corporate job to be able to put myself in a nutshell like that. But I come from a background of advertising, which is what led me to reach out to you about the podcast. Misogyny was something I experienced a lot of in the world of advertising in the 90s. It was the world of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And there may have been slight awareness, but nobody was woke in any way, shape, or form. I walked away from that job in 1998 when nobody else was walking away from six figures in a Gramercy Park apartment and all those other things to finish writing my first novel. And I had an agent. She was very excited about it. We were going to have an auction and a bidding war and all these things, and none of that happened. So, you know, I feel, you know, you call it rising from the ashes. My visualization has been Humpty Dumpty. I fell off the wall, I broke into 1,000 pieces, and I managed to put myself back together. And that's happened a couple of times, actually. And I think that if you're on any kind of committed path to understanding who you really are, and if you have experienced early trauma, you're not just going to have one dark night of the soul. It's going to happen multiple times. It's part of the healing journey, which is not like flipping a light switch and everything's good once you do that. So since I left in 1998, there isn't much I haven't done. My main focus has been as a freelance writer. So I can talk about everything from how EPA regulations affect diesel usage in RV owners to fracking and how that can be done more sustainably to politics and theater. I worked for 7 years as a standardized patient at a medical school, portraying patients with complex emotional and medical conditions to medical students to try to teach them how to be humans and not just doctors. I've worked on a ranch as a ranch hand, mucking stalls. And I mean, you know, when you're an artist, you do what you got to do. That's just pretty much the extent of it. So that is what I have done up until this point. And I am, you know, still figuring my life out at this age. I'm going to be 59 in a couple of months. And it's sometimes I get upset with myself because I feel like I'm a late bloomer. But then I look back on everything I've done. And the reality is, go on, girl. You've dealt with a lot of crap over the years. And, you know, because that job, if you've experienced early trauma and you're not aware of it, and, you know, in the 90s, trauma wasn't even a word unless you were in a car accident and sent to the emergency room. You know, there was no language, there was no understanding around how it's not a cognitive issue as much as it is a body issue. None of that existed. So my life has just been a mosaic of trauma responses, basically, until some of this stuff started to hit a more mainstream arena, and social media has helped a lot. I mean, I know people think social media can be the Antichrist, and there is no argument for me because it can be. But when I look at the amount of mental health advocates and trauma recovery specialists who are on Instagram and TikTok, it's just, it's mind blowing, you know? And there are times, if I'm honest, I think about, wow, what would have happened had that been there at the beginning of this journey for me? How different things would have been. But they weren't. So here I am. And at this stage, I am committed to sharing my successes and failures in all arenas of my life. I develop tools for people to hopefully find value in their journeys, because my take on my life is that I am a link in the chain of evolution, which is a lot more than opposable thumbs. And if we are to evolve as a species, it must include emotional, spiritual, and mental evolution, as well as physical. And it's work. You know, you wouldn't expect to go into the gym and a week later come out looking like Heidi Klum. That's ridiculous. Nobody would expect that. But I think people expect that of being on any kind of spiritual path. And so, you know, I just like talking about it because I like blowing up the myths about what it really is and what it can look like, especially if you've had childhood trauma.
You said a lot there. There is definitely a lot for us to unpack. I want to start with the job that you had working with the doctors. That is amazing, because my favorite thing anytime that I've been at work where you're learning things and doing new things is scenarios and role playing. Like, I so get into that. People probably hate me because, like, I'm into the scenario. How cool was that to do? Or did it get really old after, you know, a year?
You know, unfortunately, like a lot of workplaces, there ended up being other things involved besides the actual work that kind of drove me away from it. And, you know, a part of that is I feel like they were profiling, and I'm not saying they did it consciously, but I feel like they were profiling people who could handle the very complex emotional cases. You know, the single teacher at the age of 50 who's depressed, who goes to the doctor with a new symptom every 3 months. You know, the patient with diabetes who's blind and has neuropathy in the feet and is trying to figure out what their next step is. Somebody who's had a heart attack or a stroke and is trying to go through the recovery process there. Those types of scenarios require an enormous amount of emotional output. Then there were the psychiatric cases. I portrayed somebody who was bipolar while they were in mania. And that was an enormous output. And I didn't feel like there was enough addressed around creating a safe space after those experiences, creating a place for recovery after those experiences. And ultimately what I realized was that job was a trauma response, because it put me in the heart of things that were hurting me, but I was getting paid. Mm-hmm. So there we have it. That's just the truth, you know? And the work is important. You know, I don't know whether or not you know this, but the medical boards now require a standardized patient activity in order for a medical student to actually pass the board. So, you know, there's a glimmer of hope in Western medicine. And, you know, I will say a glimmer, because what I see is that medical schools in general, and I'm not going to name anybody specifically, but medical schools in general are concerned about the money. The fact that the university is a nonprofit is a misnomer, in my opinion. And the standardized patient program offers a lot of results that are not tangible. And if it's not tangible, it's more challenging to make money from it. And so, I mean, I think they ought to be doing one every trimester. They ought to be doing an activity every trimester from the second they start to the second they graduate. And some medical schools do that. The one that I was working for really amped up in the 7 years I was there. They really, really did. But it's just so, you know, it's such a combination of things, because it's teaching them about sexism. It's teaching them about racism. It's teaching them about, again, just how to be a human being, how not to look at a patient as a Rubik's Cube. Because unfortunately, a lot of times in the medical world, especially in Western medicine, they're collecting data so they can identify the symptoms that will then hopefully tell them what the problem is. And instead, they're not listening to the patient's story in a way that would get them to the heart of the matter so much more quickly. You know, I'm big on storytelling. I still tell stories on stage. I tell stories throughout my life. I just, it's so important to me. That is how, that is the advantage human beings have over other primates and animals, you know, is our ability to share stories with each other like this. So yeah, it was a fascinating job. I'm very grateful I did it. And I think it is something that is very necessary if the medical profession is going to continue to evolve in this country.
I absolutely agree, because I have run into some of those doctors who clearly have zero bedside manner, and it's really frustrating. And I have also been that Rubik's Cube, which is also very, very frustrating. I do want to point out quickly that there's no way that you're 59. That's simply not possible. So we're just going to move on from that. You mentioned when you were speaking, you know, about how sometimes we repeat a pattern or we repeat a behavior, and whether that's at work or in relationships. And that's honestly what it made me think of is, you know, I have been in a domestic violence relationship, and you know, I can even look at myself and see some patterns that repeated for a time. Luckily, I finally got past them, but we seem to do that a lot. And, you know, we think we got better. We think we addressed the problem. And yet there we are again in the same situation. Why do you think that happens, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think the first thing that is the most important is kindness to ourselves above all else. The other thing I have to say about that is that we perceive progress to be linear, and it is not. It is a spiral. So while you may say to yourself in a moment of frustration and anger at finding yourself in a similar situation, it's not the same. It might be similar, but it's not the same, because you are now dealing with a different layer of that pattern, you know, because every pattern is an onion. And as I have recently discovered for myself in an area of my life, the deeper you go into the onion, the thicker the layers. That's not really talked about very much. So I am here to discuss that. And I think that when we perceive progress as linear, that's when we get stuck. Well, what's the point? If I'm just going to find myself in this kind of situation again, why am I even going to go through the tears and the suffering and the pain and all the things that accompany unraveling a pattern? But when you can reframe it as it being a spiral, and you're working your way down to the core, and you know what? It's funny. I used to joke all the time that the bitch who got my body in the next lifetime owed me big for all the work I've done. And now I'm at a point at this stage of my life where I'm like, you know what? I'm going to save some for the next person. I don't need to do it all, you know? And I think that's also a really healthy attitude because it's never going to be perfect. It can always be better, but it's never going to be perfect. So when I find myself in those situations where I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ, are you kidding me? How can I be in this place again? I do my best to take a breath and be kind to myself, particularly that small person whose energy still lives inside of me, and say, you know, okay, here we are. But you know what? Maybe, and there's a wonderful poem. I don't know if you've ever heard it. It's called A Life in Five Short Chapters by a woman named Portia Nelson. And it is a guideline for my life. I'm not going to remember it exactly, but the gist of it is, chapter one, I walk down a street, I fall a hole, I didn't see it, it's not my fault, I can't get out. Chapter two is, I walk down a street, I see a hole, I fall in, I still can't get out, it is my fault. The third chapter is, I walk down a street, I see a hole, I fall in, I manage to get out. The fourth chapter is, I walk down a street, I see a hole, I walk around it. And the fifth chapter is, I walk down a different street. And that is the process of healing for everything. And you may need to stay in chapter two for a minute, or chapter three, because, you know, one of the things that I don't know it is starting to be talked about now with, we were talking before about all the influencers on TikTok and Instagram mm-hmm. who are mental health and trauma recovery advocates. But you have to go through the process of letting go what is part of those patterns. You know, we say let go of a pattern, and it's like, oh, I'm just going to pick up this mouse and look, I've let go of it. Yeah, no. There are all kinds of spider webs attached to that mouse, and you have to clip every single one of them. And some of them are people, and some of them are jobs, and some of them are living spaces, and some of them are beliefs, and some of them are habits, and some of them are resistance. I mean, there's so many different threads that connect us to that pattern. And so you may need to be in chapter two for a minute, and that's okay. Because as long as you're taking a step, that's what counts. It's consistency in the healing journey. That's what matters. And that doesn't mean that you're doing it every day, because that can be a lot. I know, because I do it every day. Not everybody's cut out for that. You know, I've had friends say to me, my God, how do you even like work or do anything else? And at this stage, I move through realizations and recognitions pretty quickly, but that's not always been the case. It's like going to the gym. You know, I'm able to do it because I've been doing it consistently for almost 30 years now. So you just can't get angry with yourself. And if you do, understand that that anger is really sadness, that you're not someplace else yet, that you don't have what you say you want. And then when you can find a way to be compassionate for your sadness, the anger goes away. And then you're free to move to the next step.
I love that. And I love your pointing out that it's actually sadness and not anger. And I relate that to, you know, my situation when I was a police officer and I was living in a DV relationship, and I would go on calls to mainly women, you know, who were victims of domestic violence. And when I would leave, I would get angry, you know, at them. And say, why aren't they doing better for themselves? Why don't they see their worth? Why don't they understand that this is never going to go away? And really, I was talking to myself. You know, I didn't realize it at the time. And I think you're right. It was probably sadness at my own situation, you know, versus anger, especially at them or even at me. So I love that you pointed that out. why do you think that we are so hard on ourselves in general?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with three different things. I think it has a lot to do with the environment in which we're raised and the values that are that the people who raise us, whether they're our birth parents or whatever the situation happens to be, whoever your adult authority figures are going to be a huge influence there. I think it also has to do with societal and cultural norms and mores, because our society says you're a success when you have a lot of money. You're a success if you own a Tesla or a McMansion or whatever it happens to be. And in order to get those things, you have to keep pushing and pushing. And as I was on that path when I was living in New York, excuse me. And I think the third thing is the media, you know, magazines and television and all the kinds of things that we consume in huge quantities, most of us. And even social media, I will throw into that mix, that shows teeny, teeny, tiny slivers of people's lives that just appear to be, you know, I mean, Kim Kardashian's a perfect example. So she was wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress to the Met Gala. Her life's a shit show. I mean, come on, you know? And I don't, I've never been a fan. I've never watched any of their shows or anything else. You have to be under a rock not to get some of it if you're on social media. But that's not the truth. What we see in social media and television is not the truth. And we take that in as truth and then try to live up to this idealistic Walt Disney-esque standard that is impossible. And I think that's why we're hard on ourselves. And I also think the other reason we're hard on ourselves is because particularly women, we think we're connected to who we really are, and we're not. You know, I have one of my best friends was in a workshop for empaths. And the question was, what is your favorite color? And she didn't have an answer. And she couldn't understand why she was so devastated by that. I mean, tears, and she's not a crier, the whole thing. And what the question about color was a proxy for the fact that she had never stopped to ask herself what mattered to her in her life. And I don't think that's uncommon. And I think that we get so disconnected from ourselves, our feminine energy, our maternal instincts, whether they're with birth children or with friends and other family members, can take over. And then we're always on the back burner. And so when you have, and we're angry about that, let me be clear. We are super pissed off about that, but it's not something that's conscious. So you have that bubbling underneath the surface. And depending on the amount of rage you actually have underneath the surface, that can just, something so simple can trip you. And the reaction is just bigger than the situation calls for. And I think that's also a factor in, and then we beat ourselves up for it. Well, you can do better. That's not really who you are. How, why are you so angry? That, well, you know, you're being too sensitive. You're asking for too much. You need to calm down. Now, all the things we were told that we absorbed, we're now telling ourselves. And I think that for a lot of women, that keeps us in a perpetual cycle of that anger and that perfectionism and that being hard on ourselves.
Something else that I read about you or read that you talk about that I found very interesting was how we gaslight ourselves quite often. And, you know, we've talked a lot about gaslighting on this podcast, and I think everybody kind of knows what it is now, but I never really thought of it in that we were doing it to ourselves. So will you talk a little bit about how that works and how that can keep us stuck in a situation where we shouldn't be?
If you find yourself saying, it'll be okay. It's not that bad. I just need to put on my big girl panties and deal with it. I would invite you to do some further exploration, because not always, because sometimes you do just need to put on your big girl panties and deal with it. You know what I mean? But if you find yourself saying those kinds of phrases on a regular basis, again, I invite you to explore that for yourself. Do some journaling. Have an honest conversation with somebody in your inner sanctum who only has your back, who's not concerned about any, who loves everybody in your life, but you're their focus. Excuse me. Because there's a really good chance you're gaslighting yourself. And the first time I ever, and I didn't realize it till years after I had left, but I was doing that in my advertising job in New York a lot. You know, I was telling myself, because I was, the way the business worked at the time, and maybe it still does, because I got into sales from working in an ad agency, because for a female in the media department, and I was working at the number one ad agency in New York City at the time, but there was a doorstop on salary in terms of what I was going to be capable of making. And that wasn't acceptable to me. So I got into sales because the income was exponential with possibilities. And, you know, I got under contract. I finally got hired after an unbelievable boot camp of interviews. Finally got hired for the job I thought I wanted. And it was on an all-male sales team with a male sales manager and a male national sales manager. And the things I experienced were just horrific. Looking back on it, I'll give you one example. We were dealing with three station people who would come in from a market that we represented. I basically sold airtime to advertising agencies for their clients. So we represented stations in different parts of the country and sold their commercial airtime for national advertising. Big clients, you know, movie studios and car manufacturers, those kinds of things. And so these three people came in from this market. We usually only got one representative from the station. It was usually their national sales manager. So all the guys and my two male managers are sitting in the conference room with these three guys. And one of my managers says, well, you know, could you tell me a little bit about yourselves? So they each take a turn. And the last guy goes, let's just say I'm a gynecologist because I like to explore things. And then he went on when he was asked about why three of them came to New York instead of just sending one person as was usual. Well, we like to gangbang the buyers. We find that's more effective. Now, I had had lots of more subtle things, excuse me, happen, but this was big. And I remember leaving that meeting, going into the bathroom and having basically a nervous breakdown without understanding what was happening. I felt, in retrospect, I felt so violated and invisible. And like, I didn't matter, nor did the millions of fucking dollars that I brought into their station every year. And I told myself, well, you're just going to have to deal with it, Stacy. You're under contract. No other rep firm in the city will touch you until your 4 years of being under contract. It never occurred to me that I could pick a different career. I was so invested in my goal that it never occurred to me that there was another way out. There's always a third option. I'm a huge fan of Carl Jung's third option theory that says if a human being is presented with two options, neither of which appeals to them, most of the time they will choose one or the other rather than sitting in the discomfort of the unknown. But if you can sit with the discomfort, a third previously inconceivable option will show itself to you. And I wasn't in a place to exercise my third option. Because I was gaslighting myself. Well, you're doing this for a reason. You're doing it so you can make $100,000 a year. You're doing it so you will be successful. So this is just part and parcel of the game. You just have to suck it up and deal with it. So we'll add those phrases to the ones I mentioned previously. If you're saying anything along those lines, you might be gaslighting yourself. And fear is the only reason we do that to ourselves, because we fear that we're worth what we're receiving. we fear that we can't break free from it. And we fear that we won't have what we need and want if we don't allow ourselves to be hurt in the process. And those three things will keep you stuck in being gaslit. And I say all the time, the mirror is forever and only your best friend. So if you're in a situation like that, you need to walk your ass into the bathroom and look in the mirror and say, how am I participating in this? And what is it I really want? And then wait for the answers to come, because I envision my subconscious like a castle with a moat and a gargoyle at the gate. And sometimes that gargoyle is asleep and data gets out into my conscious mind so that I can deal with it. And other times, whether it's from a protective standpoint of, you know, she can't deal with that right now, so we're not going to let that out. Or no, because if she knows, it's going to mean too much change is coming and I don't want to deal with that. There can be a number of reasons that that gatekeeper doesn't want to let the information out. So it might not happen right away, but if you are pure in your intention to know, that information will show up for you. And it could be in a song lyrics. It could be on a TV show. It could be in an innocent conversation with somebody while you're checking out your groceries. You have to pay attention, but it will show up.
You talked about fear and, you know, fearing this third option and sitting in the unknown. Will you talk a little bit about fear versus danger?
Yes, that's an important distinction. And that is a pair of words that is often conflated. Because fear, and I think the best way I've been able to do it is to make a conscious decision to sit in some memories and understand where I feel each of those things in my body. Because I don't know that your mind is an accurate barometer in that situation, especially if you've experienced early trauma, especially if that early trauma involved any kind of physical violence. You know, I don't know that you're gonna get an accurate reading from your brain, but your body will never lie to you. So, and you know, this is not mental health help. I am not a licensed therapist, so let me be clear about that. If you have one, you might want to discuss it with them. But what I did for myself was I took myself to a couple of different places where I was in danger and when I just was afraid, and saw where that difference was in my body. When I feel fear, it's in my throat. That's where I get it. When I'm in danger, my whole body is on fire. So for me, that's the tell. If I'm feeling like their hands around my throat, that is my feeling of anxiety, which comes from fear about the future. So that's how I do it. If you have a therapist, I would discuss it with them and see if, you know, because sometimes going back into a memory can end up triggering some things and causing reactivation in the nervous system that you might not be anticipating. So you want to make sure you're with somebody safe and that you're in a safe environment. But my short answer is the body will know.
How difficult was it for you to get to that point where you could recognize the difference, and then when you're experiencing fear, to take that step back and say, it's okay, I feel the hands around my throat, but that's okay, it's just fear.
That's a lot. And it was a process for me. I mean years and years to get to the point where now when I feel that, or I wake up in the morning and I've got some anxiety, you know, the default voices are still like, well, did you have any sugar last night? You know, what did you eat? Blah, blah, blah. Because food has been my substance of choice for as long as I can remember. And so that's my default reason for why everything happens in my life, you know, but once I get through those default voices, I do my best to become a parent and to say to myself, what's going on? What are you feeling afraid about? And if that part of me doesn't want to give that up, then there are lots of tools that I have at my disposal. I love 4-7-8 breathing, which is when you inhale for 4 seconds, you hold it for 7. and then you exhale through pursed lips for 8. I find that the more fear I have, the more I yawn as I move through that. And I do it until I stop yawning. I love EFT tapping. That is something that works for me. I have friends who does nothing for them. But I'm a writer. I'm a linguist. Language is my life. I can create an EFT script for myself as I'm doing it, you know, and bring myself back into a place of peace. There's a newer technique called havening, which is basically it's human touch with yourself. So you start with your hands and then you move to your shoulders, just in gentle gliding touch. So there are so many, because basically what you're talking about is a dysregulated nervous system. Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you feel fear or anxiety. So it's sometimes if you can't use your brain to get to the root of what's going on, then you've got to go to the body. And maybe you go to the body first. You know, I'm used to surviving on my intellect, so that is still my default. Mm-hmm. But I now recognize that that is not always going to give me what I need, which is why I've begun over the last 15 years or so exploring other ways to return my nervous system. You know, I recently discovered that the sounds of bird chirping is calming. And that's because birds don't chirp when there's danger. So somehow our limbic brain connects to that and knows that we're not in danger if the birds are chirping. 9 million YouTube videos with bird song, you know? So there are ways, you know, and I would really encourage people, if this is an issue for them, go to TikTok and search and do a hashtag anxiety search, mm-hmm. or on Instagram, because there are so many people out there providing such wonderful information about how to bring your nervous system back to a place where you're not a high functioning person with anxiety. Because I think we have a lot of that in our world today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like a high functioning alcoholic. I lived with one for years. You know, everybody thought his jobs were steps up the ladder. No, he just kept getting fired because he kept going out to his truck and drinking beers in the cooler in the back seat. So, but he still had a job. He was still getting a paycheck. So, you know, we can all be high functioning whatevers. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us to figure out if we are.
I want to talk for a minute about the workforce, because, you know, you talked about being at the advertising agency or in that field, and you gave the examples that were ridiculous, you know, and in one sense, it's like we think, well, I can't imagine that happening. But in reality, it still happens today. There's still male-dominated fields. And when women enter them, we feel the pressure to conform, or we're a bitch, or we're too sensitive. So what can we as women do to dial that down? And what I mean by that is to make our presence known and to say we're uncomfortable if we're uncomfortable without being the bitch. And then what can men do to help the situation as well?
That's a very large question. And I don't know that my answer is going to be the popular one, because my perception is, if you believe, all right, first of all, you can't control what somebody else's perception is of you. Mm-hmm. So if a man in a workplace is going to think you're a bitch, is going to think you're difficult, there's not a fucking thing you can do about that. And I think that's the biggest mistake women make, is trying to change what the perception is. Mm-hmm. How can I mold myself, shape myself, fit myself into this cone of expectation so that I fit in? My take on your question is, fuck that, make your own way. You know, I have pretty strong thoughts and feelings about the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s. And while I have huge respect for Gloria Steinem and the women who were her compatriots and them doing the best that they could with what they had at that time, in retrospect, I feel like it was about teaching women how to be a success as a man. and not teaching women how to be successful as a woman. Mm-hmm. How to use our feminine nature, our compassion, our sense of empathy, our nurturing instincts. How can we be successful using those? Because I believe you cannot change the rules of the game until you've won. And if you are a mid-level manager or lower, or even if you're the CEO of the company, you are still dealing with a board mm-hmm. that is probably mostly old white men. You know, you're not going to change it. And I think it is because I tried, Claudia, I tried for so long. And I just feel like I don't usually say always and never, because that's the kind of thing that comes back and bites you in the ass. What I will say is that it would be an extraordinary environment where you as a female would be able to say, when I heard she's so difficult to work with if she doesn't get her way, I felt like my feelings didn't matter. And have that affect change. Wow. Wow. In a male-dominated environment, I'm sorry, I just don't see it happening. You know, so we can either continue to take it, and when we do, what that ends up doing is it perpetuates the other females are our enemy belief. And as long as that's going around, I don't care how many Virginia Slims commercials there are, we have not come a long way. And so I encourage women to find the right prom date. You know, there are, you know, instead of dealing with it once you're in there, throw up some flags, send some canaries down into the mine during the interviewing process. Because if you think you're going to change it once you're in, and now you're in, you're invested, you're getting a paycheck, part of your benefits are being paid for, blah, 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 blah. All a delusion of security, by the way, but that's a different story. But if you don't deal with it till you're there, you're going to have to go. The way to deal with it is to ask the questions in the interviewing process and then have the courage, if it doesn't feel right, not to take the job. No matter how much your brain is telling you, it's the perfect thing. That's my best take on that. I think it's a fallacy to think you're going to change it if you're in a male-dominated industry.
I want to cheer for you right now. I want to stand up and clap. I think you're so right. And I love that you said to talk about it in the interview and have the courage not to take it. The position that I have right now, when I had my first interview, there's a gap in my resume because I did not put a certain job on there because of something that happened at that job. And I felt really comfortable with the interviewer. And I said, you know what? I just want to go ahead and address this. And if it makes me not the right person for the job, that's fine. This is why there's a gap. Here's what happened to me. But what I want you to know is that that affects how I feel now about where I'm going to work. And I must work with people with integrity and ethics and morals. And if this is not that place, that's okay. Like, I'll move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. And that's scary to do.
Terrifying.
It's very terrifying. So what else can we do, or how can we get ourselves to the point where we can all have the courage to say and do that?
Well, I think, you know, I will take a page from my mother's book. And she was in a very, very challenging job where she was being horribly mistreated and wanted to quit. But again, the money, right? But what I want to say about that is money is a proxy most of the time. And that doesn't mean that it's not necessary to live in our society. It is. You need it to secure a living space. You need it to eat. You need it for transportation, all kinds of things. So I'm not ignoring that. But what I have found is that if you're radically honest with yourself, there's something underneath it. It's never just about the money. And so at that time, she was coming home from work and crying. And her boss was a woman, let me say that, okay? And one day she sat down and she made a list of all the things that she knew how to do. She knew how to wash a car. She knew how to do laundry. She knew, and she just made a list, ended up being like 2 or 3 notebook pages full of skills that she had that if she walked away from that job, she could make money doing. And I think that is a healthy step to take if you're in that situation, because no good decisions ever come when you feel trapped, ever. When you're feeling desperate, you're gonna make a stupid decision. That is just a guarantee. And so the goal is not to feel trapped. And the way you can do that is by reminding yourself who you are and what you're capable of. You know, maybe you're a really good resume writer. You know, maybe you're a great baker and you could make muffins for the coffee shops. I mean, there are a billion different things that everybody can do, no matter their education level, no matter their work experience. And that's what I would encourage a woman to do, is to understand what her strengths are and how else she could provide for her needs without having to do that. Because, and that is deeply rooted in American women. Mm-hmm. Because I remember, this is going back like 15 years, and I wanted to do a radio show. I was living in Tampa, and the deal was you bought the airtime for X amount of dollars and blah, blah, blah. And I'm on the phone with a friend of mine, and she's like, why do you always think you have to do something you don't want in order to have what you do want? And I thought, holy shit, I do that all the time. You know, now, is that a result of the trauma? Yeah, that plays a role in it. There's no doubt about it. But I also think it's part of the macrocosm. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a part of my microcosm. And when you've got something in your microcosm that's also in the macrocosm, you're in for a good amount of work to try to unravel that. But the result, you know, and the other thing, and I think there's a lot to be said for, and I don't know what word to use, because it's not really visioning, but it's feeling. What would it feel like to be bringing in the money that you need to take care of yourself, or to have the things you want in your life without having to give up part of you? You know, but women have been taught to sacrifice since the dawn of time. Do you see men sacrificing? I'm just
saying. Not normally.
No. They're like, this is what I want. I'm going after it, and fuck whatever gets in my way. And that's their attitude. And again, I want to be successful as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a penis. I don't want to be successful as someone who does. I want to experience it in this body, in this mind, and how it feels for me. And that includes compassion and nurturing and understanding and all of those things, and not stepping on people just so I can get to the next rung. And there are ways to do that. But to, you know, to get back to your previous question, to try to do that in an environment that is stacked against you, I just think it's a setup. It's not something I'm choosing to do anymore.
I love it. I love it. Stacey, we have talked about some tough things here. We are going to take a quick turn before I let you go.
Okay.
We're going to talk about tattoos. I've been wearing long sleeves for the last several weeks. I am still, but I have them pulled up a little. So I love tattoos. Normally have my next tattoo planned. I know that you have a pretty cool story about your first tattoo, and I would love it if you would share that.
I would be happy to. So I went to a writer's conference in Maui in 1997 and was just enthralled with all the petroglyphs. And so I came back to New York City, and on the plane ride home, I designed what I wanted as a tattoo. It was a combination of woman with child and powerful woman. And so on a Saturday morning, I got myself up in my Gramercy Park apartment, and I walked over to Chelsea, And I got my first tattoo on my right ankle. And it's, I can show you, I don't mean to show you the book, but that's the tattoo.
Okay.
And it was exhilarating. But the part of it that was so cool for me is that while I was in the waiting room, there was a bulletin board and it had all kinds of colorful flyers on it for concerts and underground plays and performing arts and all kinds of stuff. But in the middle, there was a plain white sheet of paper and on it in Sharpie marker, it said traditional Lakota sweat lodge, call Alvin. And along, I'm Alvin, okay. And a 516, which is a Long Island phone number. So I took the number and I really vacillated, but I ended up going. I took myself to Mineola all alone on the Long Island Railroad. I walked because there was no Siri or Google Maps or anything like that. So I have a napkin with the directions he's given me and my cherry cobbler for the potluck afterwards. And I got to the front of the, I passed like all of the beautiful pastel cottages and Cape Cods and manicured lawns. And I'm in an area where none of that is. And I get to the address and there are bed sheets in the window. And I'm like, this is either going to be the best experience of my life or I'm about to become a lampshade. One of the two things is going to happen. And it ended up being the most incredible experience of my life, where I stripped down to a jog bra and shorts and sat in a teepee in Alvin's back. He's a Lakota chief in his backyard. His wife did the ceremony, which is called Inupi, is the sweat lodge ceremony in Lakota. And I quit my job 8 months later.
Wow.
But I never would have gone to that sweat lodge had I not gone to get the tattoo. So, you know, that's something that I remember a lot, is that we think we're doing something for a reason we've designated in our minds. The universe is so much bigger than your mind. And who knows why it's being done? Which is why, even though it is challenging for me to this day, I do my best to just be in the moment and go with it instead of focusing on the outcome that I say I want.
I think that's probably the best tattoo story that we've ever gotten. And I'm so grateful you did not become a lampshade.
Yes, me too.
Stacey, where can people find you? So if they want to get your book that you just held up, if they want to talk to you about, you know, what they can do to be happier in the workplace, or if they want to get Alvin's phone number, where can they find you?
Well, my website is stacyb.com and it's Stacy with an I. And quick, funny story about that. That used to be a porn webcam site when I first tried to get it back in 1999. And then 3 years later, I was like, well, just for kicks and giggles, let me see if it's available. And it was, because this is before auctions and all kinds of things happened for domain names. So she had let it go and I was able to get it. So it's stacyb.com. And all my social media is, hey, it's me, Stacy B. Instagram. I have a private Facebook group and I keep it private so people feel safe. But because that's something that's very important when you're sharing about these kinds of issues that can make you feel really vulnerable. It's important that you feel safe. So that's where people can find me. I'm up to all different kinds of things. Sometimes I change direction because that's just what feels right. So
and that's okay, because you are doing you. Yep. Stacy, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate everything you shared, and I know it's going to be so meaningful to the audience. So thank you.
Thank you so much. That's my whole goal, you know, because if you can't share what you've learned, what the hell's the point in going through it?
Exactly. I hope you guys enjoyed my conversation with Stacy as much as I did. I truly appreciate her talking about how healing from trauma isn't a linear process, but it's more like a spiral, and why we need to be easier on ourselves when we're working to heal. So remember, until next week, you are strong enough and you are worth it.
Thank you for listening to the Strong Enough podcast. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform by searching Strong Enough. And on YouTube, we're on the Spear Talk channel. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Strong Enough Pod. If you have suggestions for an upcoming episode or a future guest, please reach out at strongenoughpod@gmail.com. Remember, you are worth it.